we think that if we could just get a hold of that job where we couldn't mm-hmm. get fired, or the financial system that just right. can't crash, then everything would be fine. But in fact, there's nothing as dangerous as perfect safety.
Hi, I'm Nick Gillespie with Reason TV, and today we're talking with Megan McArdle. She's a Bloomberg View columnist and the author of the excellent new book, The Upside of Down: Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. Megan, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
What inspired you to write a book about failing well?
Well, you know, the first thing they always tell writers is write what you know.
That's
and
right, okay.
since I have failed a lot, I thought this is an area where right. I can actually claim some genuine expertise.
Okay, so, but of course you're talking about failing well. What's a good failure, what's a bad failure?
Okay, so a bad failure is, first of all, it's a failure where you don't learn anything, mm-hmm. where you let it crush you and you don't move on. You just keep trying to do the same old thing that didn't work the first time, right? Failure is nature's way of saying, stop, that doesn't right. work. And so the key to good failure is, first of all, recognizing that you've failed, and that's, sounds dumb, but you'd be shocked at how many people just keep refusing to admit that things are going wrong, even when it's fairly obvious.
So this is kind of like an Anthony Weiner situation.
Well, yeah. or that's one. Yeah. Yes, exactly. But I mean, everything from, you look at plane crashes, you mm-hmm. look at GM, you look at bad relationships, or right. I mean, from the whole gamut, you see the same thing over and over again, which mm-hmm. is denial is not just a river in Egypt, yeah. and people just cling to this idea that everything's okay, even when it's obvious to everyone else from the outside mm-hmm. that it's not. Second thing is to, like, fairly low cost failure. Now, it isn't that failure shouldn't hurt, it should, because again, if it didn't hurt, we wouldn't stop. But it needs to hurt in a specific way, which is it should encourage you to move on and not be catastrophic. And then the third thing is moving on, is having recognized that you failed, having identified the lessons that you can, how do you then let go of the past and move forward?
You write at one point that the opposite of failure is not safety, it's nothing. What do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about it, right, a lot of people right now, especially, they're looking for that guarantee. They're looking for a sure thing. And we think that if we could just get a hold of that job where we couldn't mm-hmm. get fired, or the financial system that just right. can't crash, then everything would be fine. But in fact, there's nothing as dangerous as perfect safety. It means that you're not innovating. And in today's economy, it's incredibly risky is to be the guy who has settled into doing the same thing for 20 right. years and is still doing it. But the second thing is that when you think you've found a sure thing, you're not prepared for something to go wrong. And you can say in the movies that failure is not an option,
right.
but failure is always an option. And yeah. so you look at the financial crisis, a perfect example, right? Homeowners thought that they had a sure thing. Everyone thought they had a sure thing. And it collapsed catastrophically.
Well, you also write at a certain point, and this is interesting because, I mean, a lot of the book is about policy issues. It's about business, but it's also, you know, you bring it down to an individual level through anecdotes and whatnot. But you talk about kind of the way that schools teach, or our culture kind of teaches a very, very bad, very false lesson, which that is that success in work mostly depends on natural talent. Explain that a bit.
Well, if you think about how, especially bright kids go through school, right, is that everyone wants to, you learn early that success is just about being brilliant, right? You sit down and you do it and it's perfect the first time you do it. Maybe you rewrite a draft and then, and you know, you can try to tell kids that talent doesn't matter, but that's obviously a lie, right? You can look around a grammar school classroom and know who finds math easy and who doesn't. The problem is that those kids then get the message that work is that being smart is about succeeding is about finding work easy, right? The smartest kid in the class is the person just who finds it the easiest. And then that's reinforced by the way we teach. So how do you learn English, right? You don't sit down and read Tom Sawyer Detective, which is a very bad book that Mark Twain wrote
yes.
later.
And it's not as bad as Tom Sawyer Abroad, but it's getting there.
It's, yes. He wrote a series of not very good books later in life because he was desperate and bankrupt mm-hmm. and needed the money. And you don't read any of those books, and you
right.
don't read the drafts. And you know, one of the stories I tell in the book is I was at a seminar with 12 English professors and me. And we're discussing Moby Dick, and he has this chapter on the rules for determining whether you're allowed to hunt a whale or whether mm-hmm. it's someone else's. And at the end of the book, it's a fast fish, which means that you can hunt it, or that you can't hunt it, or a loose fish, which is one that's fair game. At the end, he says, "And what are you, dear reader, but a fast fish and a loose fish too?" And everyone's sitting around for like an hour. So what is it? What did he mean by this? And finally, at the end, I said, "I'm just going to throw this out here, but maybe he just got to the end of the chapter and it sounded good."
Yeah.
Just like, you would have thought that I had said, like, hey guys, after this is over, what if we just went out and killed some old ladies?
Right.
And the fact is that this is how actual writers experience it, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just get to the end. But the way we perceive it after it's written is it came out of his mind, fully right. formed, exactly what he intended, and it was super brilliant, and how dare you question these super brilliant people. Mm-hmm. That's not how they perceived themselves, and that's not right. how they worked. They had a lot of false starts. They wrote a lot of junk, better junk than I write.
Yeah.
And it's true of science, it's true of the way that we teach all of these topics, we're not showing how these guys failed and failed and failed until they finally figured
within
it out.
Within a kind of broad-based libertarian movement, I mean, it's interesting because, you know, there's a real privileging of work ethic and of try hard, try harder. But then there's also this growing idea that, well, you know, certain people have it and some people don't. And you really can't. I mean, this is in large way the message of much of Charles Murray's work. But other people who say, well, you know what, the cake is baked when you come, when you enter the world. So is that a mixed message within not just libertarianism, but a lot of how we teach, a lot of how we talk about stuff? It's really not about work. It's about whether you're anointed with the right genes and the right environment up through age 5.
Well, I would put it this way. Talent exists, right? It would be stupid to say that it doesn't.
Right.
You can look at different kids and see that they have different levels of ability at different things. On the other hand, you know, my mother grew up in a town where the state school for the mentally retarded was. Mm-hmm. And there was a guy there who could wax cars better than anyone's ever seen. It was amazing.
This isn't a Cuomo joke, is it?
No, sadly. Yeah. It would be a great Cuomo joke. But the fact is that, like, talent comes in different forms,
right.
and not all talents are exactly the talents right. that make you a good magazine writer, for example. I would also say this, is you can write this book, and I tried really hard to avoid this, of just saying, look at all these great, smart, successful people who
right.
failed, you can do it too, right? I can't be Thomas Edison. But on the other hand, I'm better as a writer, mm-hmm. which I failed into, than as a management consultant, which is what I thought I was going to do. And that it's not about saying that anything is possible, because that's not true, but better is possible.
Is it possible that we're entering an age where a kind of dominant metaphor is the iterative process of software releases? So you have version 1, 1.1, et cetera, kind of repeated efforts that get you closer to better or to good?
I actually think that Silicon Valley does have this metaphor of fail faster, right? Mm-hmm. You try something, and if it doesn't work, you kill it, and then if it does work, you improve it. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that it's really good that that's become a much more dominant metaphor mm-hmm. in our culture for how success happens. But it's important to say that that is always how success has worked in mm-hmm. all industries and in American society. And in fact, what we've always been really good at is encouraging people to try stuff, even stuff that's a little crazy. And then if they don't succeed, saying, well, hey, I really admire you for trying. And that's not true in all cultures. And it's been a tremendous strength of America that we do admire people who try things, and we pick them up afterwards and say, okay, that was great, go try again.
Well, that raises a question. Talk a little bit about kind of societal learning curves, right? Because, I mean, obviously this is about individuals and small groups, but then on a larger level, do certain societies fail better and learn how to succeed better as a result of that, and others not so well? And can you give us examples?
Yeah, I mean, I think you look at cultures that have become, where their institutions have become stagnant, that's often a result of shifts in the culture themselves. So you look at Mandarin China as an example that I've talked about a lot, is that, you know, they ended up setting things up so that entry into the bureaucracy was done by this one exam, heavy on Confucian sayings, and that if you could pass that hurdle, you would be super successful, right? And it would be, eventually you would go back to your province, and you would be rich, and you would be good for your family, and so forth. And here's the thing, is that so we've created this giant pass-fail mm-hmm. test. It's a way of, first of all, instituting a phenomenal amount of conformity,
right.
resisting change, and so forth, and then it broke. I mean, you can argue that the Communist Revolution, in some ways, was just the fracturing of a system that had become so interlocked
mm-hmm.
and so... and so, yes, culture is absolutely how they treat failure. It does change over time, and it does matter a lot in terms of how successful they're able to be.
You talk about a concept called blamestorming, and particularly in the context of the financial crisis. Explain brainstorming, and then let's talk a little bit about how that played out in 2008.
Well, blamestorming is just like brainstorming, where we all get together in a group, except this time we're trying to figure out who the villain is and who has done us wrong and
right.
find the scapegoat
mm-hmm.
for whatever just happened. I think you see that after any major crisis,
right?
Right? I mean, you see that.
But there's a particular attempt to search for, everybody has the villain, right?
Right.
I mean, this is part of the problem, is that you're not only just looking for blame, but everybody has a different sense of who it is, and that everything proceeds from one single cause.
And exactly, is that you look to me when I look at the financial crisis, I see lots of people, none of whom are any, or I should say very few of whom are greedier and stupider than the average person, but who in a kind of bad situation in the market where they're all getting a bad signal for the market about housing prices and they all make a bunch of bad decisions because of that. But most people don't see that. They see greedy homeowners or greedy banksters or evil Republican-led regulators or whatever it is. They see some person who did this rather than looking at a system that unfortunately can occasionally go wrong because systems fail just like people do. And I think it's bad in two ways. I mean, the first is you can settle on someone who, if not exactly innocent, because I think everyone had some level of greed and not being perfectly responsible, certainly isn't more guilty than many other people, and then you ruin that person's life. But the other thing is that then you don't fix the problem, right? We're all focused. If the great comforting thing about brainstorming is that it gives you a cause that's really easy to remove, right? A person, you can just, okay, fire that person, put them in jail, whatever. A system's hard to fix. And so you focus on something that is easy, but not actually going to fix the problem very well, instead of these giant systemic problems that are a lot harder to address.
Do you think in the case of the financial crisis, and obviously there have been a lot of, you know, a lot of legislative and policy decisions that have been made in the wake of it that we don't even know what they really are for years. I mean, forget the Iraq war. It's going to take longer to figure out what Dodd-Frank is, much less how it impacts things. Is this an example where we failed well, or are we still failing without even realizing it?
I mean, I would say with Dodd-Frank, there were some things that we did that are right. I mean, one thing that you look at is fractional reserve banking systems, which is a modern banking system as we all know it. They tend to have crises. And so what one thing that Dodd-Frank did that was smart was say, look, if you want to be in these markets, you need more capital. You just need, like, because for the same reason that having 5% down on your house is riskier than having 25% down. So that was basically a smart regulation. We did things like that that are designed to enhance transparency or to give regulators the better, and people, individuals, just better ability to see what's inside these banks. On the other hand, we also did a lot of things that had nothing to do with any of this, like interchange fees. You know, we decided that we didn't like how much Visa was charging retailers, and those sorts of things, they're bad in two ways. I mean, first of all, they lard up the bill with, and all of the legislative fighting then ends up getting focused on this thing that doesn't matter, but also then they suck up regulator time, right? If you're gonna have bank regulators, you want them focused on basic things like, our banks are not gonna fail and wipe out everyone's savings, not really tangential things like, is Visa charging retailers slightly too much to use every time you swipe a credit card?
Well, we will leave it there. The book is The Upside of Down, Why Failing Well is the Key to Success. It's written by Megan McArdle, who's a Bloomberg View columnist. You can see her work at Bloomberg View on a daily basis. Megan, thanks for talking to us.
Thanks for having me.
For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.